an understanding of philosophical viewpoints, whether deontological, teleological, or existential philosophical view. You're all obtaining excellent epistemology based on a hermeneutic, and you all now understand all that, at least cursory. So now you can engage the collegiate elite and understand where their hermeneutic comes from, or how they've arrived at their epistemology, how they understand the concept of knowledge and interpretation, and how it's predicated and inculcated into concepts of your deontological normative view versus an existential Kantian view, right? So you're getting there. And I know you may be 13 or 14, but I'm telling you, 40 and 50-year-olds don't have that down yet. But you can help them in a spirit of respect and kindness. What I'm going to try to do is throw away my notes, my blanket, if you will, and I am just going to review my slides. And I think by doing this, we may be able to float through these topics a little quicker. At least kill these up here. Let me see what happens if you kill all of them. Negative. That's not going to work. All right, so we'll do that. And I just need to find my... Hey, listen, if at any time you don't want me to throw something at you, it's filled right here. Just come on up or I'll just toss it. Okay, here you are. This is your Youth Winter Conference advance, because we are not retreating. We are the church triumphant here on earth. We are emboldened to speak the truth in love. We are the only individuals on the face of this planet that are to be salt and light. So act that way. Have a motive of love in obedience to our benevolent Savior and understand who you are in Christ. So we're going to talk about women first because, well, I just like women, so. A woman. When you're born, you've got between 2 and 5 million of these oocytes that become eggs. Throughout the course of your life, by the time you're at puberty, you're down from about 5 million to 400,000. And by the time you have your cycles, that's why women are so much stronger and mightier than men. I could not do what you ladies do every couple of weeks. So I'm just saying, you're mightier than I. This is actually happening at the follicular level. So at the end of the fallopian tube, you've got these areas, and this is for the artists in the group, where the egg is actually made and comes to fruition. And then when you ovulate, not you men, but when the women ovulate, with every ovulation, there's about 1,000 oocytes, that primary egg, that are lost. So by the time you are from your ability to give birth, from about 8, well, the number has changed now to about 16, to about 40, you have about 450 eggs that have been viable. So we've gone from 5 million to 400. This is not the sun. So this is an ovum. The area all around the outside is called the zona radiata, and that has chemicals in it. It has proteins and processes that allow the sperm to actually come in and fertilize this egg. And there's many layers. And here's just another artistic rendition of what the ovum looks like with this corona radiata, or zone of radiation. And you can kind of tell. And then this diddly membrane and all these layers. So what I'm doing is I'm taking 3 hours of medical school embryology in about 4 slides. And the incredible part is, and this is the sperm has a flagellum, that's that long tail-like substance. And if you see the head of the sperm, so on your right, my left, there's about four different layers on the tip of that sperm cell. And each of these contains specific enzymes that, if you will, I'll be a funny, cohabitate with that corona radiata, and through that chemical interaction, it opens up that vitelline membrane. Do you see the vitelline membrane on there? To allow fertilization to occur. So here's just another representation. This is for the mechanical engineers in the room, that it has to, that flagellum has to be powered by ATP. It has to be able to swim. The men form sperm in about 74 days. The ejaculate is about 5 cc's, about a teaspoon most of the time, and contains millions of sperm. But only about 10 make it through this torturous pathway. So when this actually occurs, and this is through an electron microscope, my embryology teacher at the end of the class did one of these. It's just a miracle that anybody has babies. And I was one of the what they called front row gunners. I sat in the front row, and I said, amen. So if no one knew my faith, they did at that moment. Because he was testifying. I talked to him afterwards. I said, tell me about your faith, because you said it's a miracle. Tell me about your understanding of a miracle. And he did. He said, George, the statistical analysis of fertilization is astronomically small. God is great. And you can use that A word right now. Awesome, that's right. Yeah, I'll let you say it this one time. So here it is just depicted for you on actually what takes place. I'm showing you all this so when we get to more deeper substance, you'll understand how miraculous this process is. So now we've had fertilization. I want everybody here to know my biblical position on personhood, on the unity of the immaterial and the material, the Ruach, spirit, breathed from God, and the body is right now. As soon as you see that, you have a person, period. This is so nebulous within science, and it needs to be because individuals want to harvest, and I'm sorry I use that word, they want to take these cells. Because these cells are what are called typically embryonic stem cells from an embryo. So here it is, and this is called the morula, M-O-R-U-L-A. And the morula has something called totipotent stem cells versus pluripotent stem cells. And the reason scientists want these totipotent stem cells, basic cells, is because you can trigger these cells either chemically or with an electrical impulse to be changed to any cell line in the body. Cornea cell, bone cell, nerve cell, brain cell, you name it and it can do it. You did some recreating, brother. So, all right, I'll leave him alone. So here's the totipotent from the morula. Okay? Again, these cells people are trying to obtain for the betterment is it existential or teleologic? What do you think the philosophical underpinning between the death of this person to obtain these totipotent embryonic stem cells? Is it deontological? Which one is it? Which philosophical paradigm is it under? It's the end justifies the means, right, Brennan? It's teleological. We have to be very careful with our philosophical underpinnings that we've gone over. See how smart you guys are? You're actually looking at me like, I got it, George. I'm actually understanding what all these foundational structures that you laid out before us. So here now we come to this gastrolysis stage. I know I'm going really fast and you can't write, but remember I told you you can all have these slides that form this trilaminar. Here's that triadic truth again. This trilaminar, the scientists call it a structure. I still call it an individual. And this is, what's up, brother? Pardon me? It's just red. So some of the red stuff is primarily blood vessels that have been, it's a cross-sectional view. So when you slice a loaf of bread, it's you're slicing through a vessel, and that's the red. And then the placenta, if you will, is at the top. So that's placental tissue that's rich in blood vessels coming in to form this trilaminar person. Endoderm, ectoderm, mesoderm. They each have different layers, and we get different things from each of those layers. The mesoderm, we get our muscle. The ectoderm, we get our skin. And the endoderm, we get our organs. I know, what's an orthopedic surgeon talking about embryology? So now we've moved from the morula to where we get this individual called a trophoblast. And now these cells are pluripotent. And the biggest difference within the scientific endeavor is that pluripotent cells don't have the same capacity theory, the same capacity to differentiate into cell lines. The pluripotent cells only can differentiate into about 200 cell lines, where the totipotent ones really can do it all, if you will. It's the magic cell. It's the buzzword cell. But it's a buzzword in science because there's thousands of snowflake embryos that are awaiting their fate. And scientists want those. So these are all things that I could talk about in reproduction technology. There's a lot of big words, really don't worry about it. We kind of touched on it with egg donor and sperm donor. So we're going to move on. This is a pipette. It's a very little glass tube. This is called intracytoplasmic fertilization, and they're injecting sperm into an ovum. This is the morula stage. And here's that fertilized egg. Again, this is already in my books, and I could debate this with you if you'd like. This is a person. You have to somehow, in your mind, figure out when you're going to determine personhood for yourself. Is it at birth? Is it at conception when there's fertilization? Is it at a specific stage of development? Because unbelieving scientists have already figured it out. Peter Singer, remember that Peter Singer guy that I talked about speciesism, that a chimpanzee that has a family is much more important than an anencephalic child. So Peter Singer thinks that an abortion in utero 2 months before is equivalent to an abortion 2 months after ex utero. He sees zero distinction within the uterus or outside the uterus. You can abort that. You can kill that child, because that individual is just as dependent inside location, location, location. That individual is just as dependent upon the mother, and he actually even goes out to 6 months. I'm just giving you 2 months because it's so heinous even to consider, but he logically comes to that viewpoint. So now we'll just do a few stem cell, and we talked about this. These are some fancy words to make you think that I'm smart. And then I could define these. I know I'm flying through, but thank you very much. You've got a few questions, and I think the interaction that we've had, as long as I give you a good cursory walkthrough, that'll give you some opportunity to ask questions about this. And I'm going to remember, right? Good colleges don't read the slides. They let you read the slides. So many individuals, and you'll equally be confronted with this, you can even take tissue from the embryo to do genetic testing. The question is, number one, why would you do this? And if you do, what are you going to do with that information? I'm not saying you shouldn't do this. Tay-Sachs disease is primarily a disease of a Jewish lineage, and Huntington's disease is carried strictly by the Y chromosome, so male to male. So here's something that many individuals that I've counseled as well will take out a second mortgage on their home to have a child. So in vitro, whenever you see in vitro, the contra to in vitro is in vivo. One is in the body, one is in a petri dish. In vitro is in a petri dish. So you are, so this is the only way that I would actually biblically tolerate this, is husband and wife that aren't conceiving. So they're infertile, and you need to be trying for 12 months before you can determine infertility. The husband takes his healthy sperm, the wife takes a healthy egg, and they put it in a petri dish, and they go zap, and they have fertilization. Then they allow that embryo to grow, and then they implant it back into the mother. Remember that ectogenesis thing, the biobag that I was talking about? So that's why scientists are trying to develop that, so they can take anybody's sperm, anybody's egg, put it together, put it in this biobag, that artificial womb, and guess what? If they don't like what's going on genetically, guess what? They just cast it away. So it's a cascade effect. It starts very subtly, and it works under the auspices of compassion and care. Yes, ma'am? Yep. That's, well, other than the individuals that obtain the sperm and the egg. Well, what happens to the child? Well, someone's got to fork out the dinero to pay for that bio bag and 9 months of nutrition and nursing care and electricity. So someone's going to pay, and it's not going to be Medicare or Medicaid. I can assure you of that. So are you getting what I'm... I went through all those slides really quickly, but really the bottom line is that we're trying to take the place of God. So here are some stem cell statistics. Yes, ma'am? Okay, so the question is, if I'm differentiating on location with the taking of a life, period, and I don't. There are embryos for in vitro fertilization, and if they're not donated, they're going to research because they want these stem cells. Because why? Because regenerative medicine is a booming business. For instance, I take out someone's blood, I spin it down, and I get platelet-rich plasma. And it's out of the blood, so I'm okay with this. But people want it because NFL players want it. But it might actually not make you take a knee. No. So we're taking this stuff and we're putting it into joints, we're putting it into ligaments, we're putting it into tendons to help regenerate. But people are going even further. They're taking bone marrow, taking the stem cells from their bone marrow, growing it on a petri dish, and now they're injecting it into joints to help regenerate cartilage tissue. In fact, I do want to read this slide. So this is what? What is this? Good, it's a chromosome. And what do they call the chromosome at its ends? Do you know that? For a piece of, what do they call that area of the chromosome? I mean, I know the answer because I've got my cheat sheet right here, but I'm sorry. Well, I don't have it. This is called a telomere. T-E-L-O-M-E-R-E. It's a telomere, and it's the end product. This is really what degenerates first within the chromosomal pattern. Well, there's a developer, and this comes from their slide, that are helping prevent the degeneration of the telomere, thinking that they found the fountain of life. But no one has studied, and she had to leave, so the CEO of this company had to leave the country to have this done. She had to go to Brazil because it's not approved in the United States. So there's genetic engineering going on for the fountain of life. And if you can attack the telomere, the end product of the chromosome, that it'll help it, it'll slow down, it'll retard the aging process. This is Dolly. So Dolly the sheep was cloned. This is cloning. They cloned 277 embryos to get this one. And the reason people are doing this is because people want to clone humans. This is called the CRISPR gene. This is a gene that's a pair of scissors that can splice into the chromosome, and then you can attach blue eyes, 6 foot two. I'm going to go to Penn State or maybe even University of Pennsylvania. Or I love you, brother. I'm so glad you're here. Notice I didn't look at him. although it's, in any case, it's just good to see individuals that are willing to take a Saturday night and come here. But so this CRISPR gene has been developed in China because in China they would rather have boy babies than girl babies. So they're trying to figure out how to do that. And if they have boy babies, they'd like for them to be sumo wrestlers and not otherwise. So this is just another stem cell slide. And these are some methodologies. This is what Dolly was. So they take an egg, they take the nucleus out, and then they take a somatic cell, a body cell, and they take that nucleus and they put it in there, and then they zap that cell and they fertilize. It's fertilized. And that's how you get, that's cloning 101. Did you get that? Okay, so you need an egg and a sperm to fertilize, to have an individual, a person. You can, through this somatic cell nuclear transfer, somatic is a fancy word for body, for a body cell. Okay? You can take the nucleus out of the egg, out of the ovum. You can take the nucleus from the body cell. Okay? They did this all with one sheep. They just took a couple of eggs out of Dolly, took some muscle tissue, took the nucleus of the muscle tissue, put it in to the egg through that pipette. Remember that glass tube that went in? And then they put it in a special chemical environment. They give it some electrical energy of some kind, some joules or voltage. And then guess what? You have a fertilized egg now. You have a clone of that individual. What's up, Hannah? Yeah. I would say yes. Because that's the only thing that makes up a person, those two things, right? Soul and body. Okay, good. Maybe we're done with the lecture. Okay, question? Yep, great question. The only ethical dilemma with genetic engineering, for instance, in the case of even in vitro fertilization, whether you want to use the unfortunate word or not, is typically you take as many eggs as you can from the woman, as much sperm, swirl it around, and now you end up with five or six persons, fertilized eggs, and you implant two or three, hoping that one persists to a life outside of the uterus. And unfortunately, with genetic engineering, that's the road that you have to go down for the greater good. And that's where I have issues. But no, I do not have issues with the general principle that genetic engineering is inherently evil. So here are just some philosophies, some of them better than others. The utilitarian calculus, you can see that. It's really a teleological concept. They use these fancy words. Utilitarian is really utility. What is the utility of it? It's a mechanistic phrase that carries no spiritual concept. And then calculus is because you're doing mathematical equations to try to figure out the best means to arrive at an end. And then you see some of those questions. Virtue, remember we talked about the four cardinal virtues from Aristotle. Does anybody remember any of them? Okay, go ahead. What's one? justice. Go ahead, Jessa. Go ahead, Jessa. Fortitude. Hold on, we need a dude. Come on. You guys are going to be head of households one day. So raise your hands. Yes, sir. Yes.
Prudence.
And can I do just one more dude, please? Over here, a male. So we had what? Fortitude, prudence. What else did we say? Justice. So it's the last one. Go ahead in the back. Temperance. Did you catch it? Oh, man, you ought to play baseball. So that was like low in... Okay, I'm sorry. Were there any questions? I'm sorry. I mean... make sure you share, all right? Because I'm not your piñata. Here you go. You know what? Just pass them around. So this virtue, focus, remember, be fast. It focuses less, and you can read this. But it really circumvents rational thinking. It's really letting your heart lead and leaving your mind behind. And sometimes this is the way the world will argue truth with you, right? They're just going to try to get at your heartstrings. It's a trump card. Okay? And we talked about self-actualization and the heresy of Maslow. And then this is probably the closest one to biblical concept because it involves spirituality, because it shouldn't just, and it says here, other than the naturalism is because it's self-made. And that's where the error begins. Read the slide. I told you I want to get through this. So we've gone through this, right? We went through those three W's, right? The situation or the world, the word, and then the worm. Our three W's, and we are the worm. And then we talked about these ethics. Make sure they get it over on this side too, please. We did all that. So here are other topics that I really don't have time for. Nanotechnology, there's actually much study going on. They're making things the size of millimeters to put into your body. Oops. And it leads to this thing called transhumanism. So there is a large organization of thousands, to include scientists, that think that we are on an evolving process that we will eventually, and we're already doing it, unfortunately, with amputees, right? Someone loses an arm, they're taking electrodes, they're putting on an arm, and then those electrodes are in with the median nerve, the radial nerve, the ulnar nerve, and the upper extremity, and they're trying to teach the brain through those nerves to motivate, to move this extremity. Okay? Is that good? Oh, absolutely. If a man can pick up his child or grab an egg without crushing it, that's wonderful. But it eventually may lead to this transhumanism where we're part robot and part human. Yeah, LJ. Eugenics? Yeah, I know. It's a lousy slide. Yeah, thank you. I'll make sure I change that for if I ever do this again. Yes, sir. It's fine. I'll read it. Eugenics is the enhancement of human hereditary traits through various forms of intervention. Yes? Sure. So she asked the Michael Jackson question about cryogenics, about freezing a body. I have not seen anybody come back to life after they've been dead and cryogenically preserved. Although there are cryogenics, right, that are involved. Every embryo that is called a snowflake, it's called a snowflake, and it's a pretty little word because every snowflake is different, but they're being cryogenically preserved. They're on ice. Does anybody know what this is? Grab an extra piece of candy. What is this?
Griffin.
What is it?
Griffin.
It's not a griffin? Good. It's a chimera. And a chimera is a funky animal, mythical animal, that, as you can see, has a lion's head, it's got the tail of a dragon and a goat and spits out fire. And what's happening is scientists are trying to create human cellular tissue with animal cellular tissue. And this is my real statement about genetic engineering and stem cell. We're trying to create our own Tower of Babel. We're trying to reach to heaven. And we shouldn't. So that's it. So now we're going to do quickly. How'd I do? Is that pretty? That was a good speed, right? All right. That's good. I'll take it. I will remember in the future to not use my notes. Okay. All right. Forget that one. Okay. So, if I were to sit here and I did this, three children have just been killed. Every 20 seconds, there's an abortion in this nation. And the numbers are staggering. So this is really just the outline. I call this secular history. So Planned Parenthood was developed by who? Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger was one of 11 children. Her mother had 18 births and had 11 children. And imagine if Margaret Sanger in 2016 said, you know what, we're going to limit the size of poor families. She'd be hung. She would be, I mean, can you imagine if 100 years later she said this, being one of 11? Then this was a resolution from the Anglican Church that began part of its demise at this conference. And then the Pope responded, and this was his major phrase, that when conception is not possible, marital intercourse is not sinful, addressing what the Lutherans, the Anglicans, did. Let me see if I can... I want to read a couple of slides, because if not, I'll be done. It's okay if I'm done early. So we've heard euphemisms of people. The phrasing of oops, or unintended, or wow, we weren't really planning this, or even the word accident. And we all need to be careful with our words. That's why I don't say we harvest organs anymore. I think that came across pretty clearly. So for everyone here, you already know through that embryology talk on the miracle of a sperm cell fertilizing an egg. Did you catch that? So here's some more scientific statistics that God supersedes day in and day out. So not only that, but approximately 30% of every conception is lost with the period. And I'm not saying, you know, the woman's cycle. 30%. So if you're from a family of three, then guess what? You lost a sibling. I just told you Margaret Sanger had there were 11. She was one of 11 out of 18 births. And then this finally came out. The Agenaux-Naus theory. Who knows that one? Does anybody? I didn't know it either. I had to look it up. So that is, if you will, the rhythm method. Women take their temperature typically at the same time every day, and then they know when they've ovulated, and then they understand when they can have intercourse without the probability, or we'll say possibility, of fertilization. Everybody remember Onan in Genesis 38 with Tamar? And so Onan spilled his seed. He didn't fulfill his brotherly duty. And when during his union, he spilled his seed. Having been married 35 years, I can tell you from personal experience that's difficult to do. And you're in the heat of the moment. So the I'm sorry, that, maybe that was wrong to say, but it's the truth. Remember, did you see that? Marital intercourse is to foster mutual love and to abate lust. So, there. So the ELCA, this is the Lutheran Church, and you can read that. So that's where they stood. It kind of opened up a big door, but at least they made a statement. The PCUSA is on a continuum that I don't approve of, so just really whatever the heck you want. There is no ethical dilemma with any form of contraception. Focus on the family. Under the leadership of James Dobson, only allows for one form, and that's abstinence. And if we went to 1 Corinthians 7, that's really the only passage that I can, and I know there's pastors and elders in here, that's really the only passage in Scripture that says for a time that you abstain. Again, all under husband and wife. We got that one down, right? There's no sex outside of marriage. We have funny names for that, like fornication. You know that? I mean, it's husband and wife, period. So continue to save yourself. But James Dobson, only abstinence, and they use 1 Corinthians 7. And the reason they have this is the concept, this is John MacArthur, the concept is that if you begin to prevent or think you're preventing the possibility of conception, then the continued domino effect of logic is that the man can end up using the woman just for pleasure as a tool. Because now you can have a conjugal union without the conception. Do you get that? It's all right, I'm going to say it again. So here's MacArthur's. How many people here know of males that have had vasectomies that have ended up with children? Look around the room, okay? There's five people here. So Frank Ocasio, man, did I love Frank Ocasio, had eight children. He was 40 years old and a great dad. And he asked me about vasectomy. And I said, well, you could do a vasectomy, but I think you should allow yourself for the opportunity to reverse it in the future. He said, okay. So he had a vasectomy. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, he puts out an ejaculate and they look and there's no swimming sperm. So he's like, thanks, George. I'm good. 9 months later, he had a baby. So God supervenes regardless of our best efforts, and I love it. This guy is currently, I think he's still the president of the Southern Baptist College. I'm not going to read it, sorry. Read the slide. When I'm silent like that and I put my head down, it's because I'm trying to get out of the way and letting you read it. Now, this is an individual that he has foibles just like all of us do. He didn't believe the Holocaust ever occurred. But needless to say. And I think this is the attitude, all right? I mean, children are a good thing, right? If your wife is a gift from God and a blessing, and children are a gift from the Lord, should you be limiting that blessing? And this is a Reformed ethicist. I like the last statement, because that's where... Now, here's out of the Westminster Confession. I'm going to read this for emphasis. Marriage was ordained for the mutual help of husband and wife, for the increase of mankind, with a legitimate issue. I think I would have liked for them to use the word progeny as opposed to issue, but... It's okay, right? I mean, I just like progeny versus issue. And of the church with a holy seed and for the preventing of uncleanness. So here's some biblical passages. This is the guy that wrote the Helvetic Confession. So here's my mathematics for today. L plus C equals 1F. Leaving plus cleaving equals one family, okay? That's my leave and cleave, or one flesh, if you will. I see you. Yes, ma'am. Go, Jessa. Then issue. Well, for me, issue, it seems kind of messy. So as opposed to progeny, is the synonym for progeny is a descendant. And that's why I am zero smarter than any of the guys that drafted the Confession of Faith in 1600s without Google. So, Bible Hub helps. I just like progeny. I just like that word. It's, if you can do it in Scrabble, it's a huge number. So, I think culturally at that time, issue was our I'm going to say issue of the 1600s was progeny of the 1700s, was children of the 1800s, and of now, it's like, oh, I have a kid. Kid is like the baby word for a goat or a sheep, or right? I mean, you're not kids. You're either children or you're young adults. You're not kids. And that's how our semantics begin to infiltrate our thought process, and that's why I keep telling you to be a soldier and take every thought captive, and on and on and on, all those things that I've been repetitive about. The family is foundational to all social institutions. This is Jay Adams. He wrote a lot on marriage, and this Marriage Act. If you want to think about it and you want an acronym, it would be CUP, C-U-P, Companionship, Unity, and procreation, with all these verses. I have 6:30 to what? To 7:30, is that correct? And then questions for possibly? Okay. So I'm just giving you the Bible verses. I know I'm going super fast. I told you I will give these slides, and you can share them with your session, at least with your parents, and discuss them. They're great opportunities to discuss. So here are some biblical principles, and you all know these. And this is the passage out of Corinthians. Maybe I'll, you know what, I think I'm just going to take a minute to read this. I think 1 Corinthians is in the New Testament, right? And Remember, when comes levity, comes the velvet hammer. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, we don't have those, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. Again, autonomy, dependency. You're not your own. When you leave and you cleave and you become one flesh, you're to care for each other more than you care for yourself. I'm here to tell you that your spouse should be your number one neighbor, right? If you're to love your neighbor as yourself, your spouse is your first and foremost neighbor. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time. Why? That you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control or temperance. Okay? That I don't have a myriad of biblical passages on contraconception. Did you get it, brother? I'm sorry. You're writing like a fiend. Huh? You're going to cramp up. I'm sorry. Do you think you got enough? Because I'll wait. We will all wait for you, seriously. So you will already have judged me. I've told you that we only have two children. So some of you in this room that come from larger families may already have your own hidden agenda and have judged me for only having two and not having more. Right? You can. You shouldn't, but you can. So I'm going to give you four philosophies of children. So birth control is a contravention of God's purpose. So contravention is that you're against it, and you just have as many children as you have. Okay? But go ahead. You have a question on that? Okay. So the question is, a person in the front here wants to equate food with sex. And there is, believe it or not, some philosophies that are out there that in the 21st century people are equating the addiction of food to the addiction of sex. So the question really asks is it all right to fast from intercourse? Is that correct? And I would say by 1 Corinthians 7, 1 through 5, that yes, it is acceptable to do that for a period of time. Why? To devote yourselves to things more spiritual. Remember, this is within an epistle to the Corinthians where Paul says, you know, it's probably better to be single than to be married. And I'm not even going to go into that. So yes, I think it's acceptable, and that's my only real foundational proof text, if you will, that allows you to abstain or have a contraconception mentality. Like, ooh, not now, let's devote ourselves to prayer, and let's just deal with it. And when we each want to have authority over the other's body, we'll come together again. Did I answer? Great. Good question. So here's in managed abundance. So this would be the Agenau-Naus method of 1932. Women, you take your temperature, and once you see, and it's fairly, nothing's 100%, but this is actually a pretty good one. It's probably close to 90% effective. So children in moderation. So here's that concept of being prudent, using wisdom. And then the concept of even no children at all. Can anyone think of, well, maybe not. So if it's gonna injure, harm the birth mother, then probably abstain from having children. If you're a missionary and you're a young couple and you're in a very hostile environment, I may be led down the path to that you should be careful in having children in an austere environment. Although when I was in Afghanistan, Western culture, women were given birth on a Conestoga wagon. So here we go. Forms of contraception, good, bad. Hold me accountable, elders in here. So here we went through some with the withdrawal. These are the natural methods. These would all be a thumbs up for me. Okay, the periodic abstinence I just read you out of 1 Corinthians 7. These are also good. These are also acceptable. And I'll tell you why in just a second. So that's a vasectomy, or women have, as they say, their tubes tied. Men put on a condom. Women can put on their condom, if you will. And then different kinds of that's what a cervical cap is. It's really a feminine condom. Okay. This word, abortifacients, is the fertilization has already taken place. You already have a person, but now there's no implantation. It causes a hostile environment along the uterine wall. So I have counseled young couples on some IUDs. Just the copper, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands who's got an IUD. I wouldn't do that. So there are some IUD, this intrauterine device, you go to a physician's office and they take this little piece of metal, really is all it is, and they insert it through the cervix, and I already showed you a picture of a uterus and all that, and then that causes a hostile environment. It does not prevent fertilization. Bad. Now, there are some IUDs that are now being coated with chemicals. Estrogen, progesterone. And that seeping of that chemical out from the IUD for the first year or so prevents ovulation, prevents the release of an egg. I'm okay with that. RU486 is a French pill that was developed probably 20 years ago. It's really pretty much the morning after pill. I'm a no. When you've been deployed with the French, we never ate a French fry. We ate a freedom fry. We never had French toast. We had freedom toast because the French were not liked. A Depo-Provera injection. I was at, during my internship year, I was in the emergency department. A young 19-year-old came in, had been raped, and the father mandated, he vehemently wanted this injection so there would not be implantation. So I refused, of course, and my boss scolded me publicly that it was my moral duty as a physician to provide health care to this 19-year-old. And I said, thank you for your comment, no. And so he did it. I didn't get fired, but I didn't have a very good report. But I was able to talk to him afterwards after that emotional 2 o'clock in the morning discussion about abortion. So here are some mixed methods. These are probably progestin only. For ladies that take a pill, I probably would say no. And the reason for that, there's too high a percentage that you're still going to ovulate, but it's going to cause a very hostile environment and not allow implantation. So that's an abortifacient. The progestin plus estrogen, or I know all you dudes are like, are you going to move on already? But you need to be leery because you will be the head of your household. And every couple that I have counseled on birth control methods, the husband has been godly and has been taking the lead on asking the questions. Why? Because he has authority over his wife's body and he wants to do nothing but what's best for her. And that's the motive. Okay? So there's these things called tricyclics, and that's probably the best pill on the market to prevent ovulation and not cause a hostile environment in the uterus. And I would give that a go, the tricyclics. So here are some final considerations. Is it morally acceptable when they neither harm the mother nor abort the fertilized egg? Is it wrong to use medical means when there's not a mandate nor a prohibition? So this is the way I function in life. If the scriptures are silent or seemingly silent about certain 21st century topics, I tread with fear and trembling, to include a regulative principle of worship. Okay? So I take that same principle for the regulative principle of worship because the scriptures are for faith and life, and we're doing life. That's why I share 25A with all of you. I could have told you Friday night that I loved you, but I wanted to demonstrate that I really do love you by singing that and blessing my heart. That's it. There you go. I did 2 lectures in an hour. You guys were great. Turn on the lights. Yeah. It's okay. So I have questions here, unless you have some that are pertaining to this topic. We've got approximately 30 minutes. It's your time. Adults, you're allowed to ask questions as well. I just ask that you be sensitive to the youth that are here. We'll start in the back with one of the so-called man girls. Oh, I'm sorry, but others may not know you, so if you can tell us your name and where you're from. Thank you. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm 57. You're going to have to speak up.
The pill that you talked about
before? The tricyclic.
Yes. How is
that? No, I'm sorry. All those pills were birth control pills. Okay. Progestin alone, progestin and estrogen, and the tricyclic.
Oh.
Go ahead. Charity, right? All right.
So,
I told you I want to know everybody's name before I left. Okay. Yeah. Well, they don't leave them. They're paying money every month.
But they're not going to use
Right.
To me, off of that, it seems like it's not that a viable option.
So the question is, there's, I don't know the number of snowflakes, cryogenically preserved embryos, so persons that are being, that are waiting to be birthed. And because of in vitro fertilization, now couples that just wanted two or three kids have got seven embryos. And now four of them are waiting. I have some angst, but this is where I fall on the side of that individual is going to die unless we do something. And you use a proper word in adoption. They adopt. The only medical conundrum that I wrestle with is now that embryo that was my wife and I, that we don't want anymore, gets implanted into Shannon Milroy. And now, because she doesn't have any children, and now she has our child. So I have some difficulty just with the mechanical aspects of it, but it's really no different than a regular adoption, right? Someone has a child, they don't want the child, and so someone else raises that child. I just have some difficulty with the yup factor of taking my child and putting it into someone else's womb. We're going to do Emily because she hasn't said anything out loud yet. Oh, okay. I love way off topic. Okay. Wow. I'm going to repeat the question because it's so, because it's so volatile. So correct me if I misquote you, Emily. Is marriage the only method to the prevention of lust? Is that kind of what you... Yeah. Okay. Is marriage the only way to keep yourself from being tempted since being single is being better? No. I think you need to go to the Westminster Confession and the passages that it's for other things other than just keeping yourself from being tempted. Many of us, I think it's the gift of celibacy is an extraordinarily rare gift, but it is out there, and it's not just to the priesthood within the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, many of them fail within that because they don't have the gift of celibacy. So I think it's more of a rare gift. It's more the exception. Paul, and I'm not going to exegete the passage, I think Paul was talking about the dividing of affections, that if you weren't married and you were single, you might be able to devote more of your energy to the gospel, right? And I think we all understand that. Me, I would not be single and devote more of my attention to the gospel. My wife is my helpmate. My wife is not just someone to sleep with. My wife makes me better. She sharpens me. She holds me accountable. She loves on me when I don't love on myself. She keeps me from running more than 10 miles right now because she doesn't want me to stress my body. And sometimes I obey her. I'm just being real. Another question. Because I've got him here. Jess's hand was up and then you're up. Okay, so how do you debate someone in the concept of rape that wants an abortion? So I think first and foremost, you may need to discuss how they got into that situation. That's the hard part. How did you arrive there? You can just debate it by two wrongs don't make a right. You don't know if that single act, I talked to you about all the miraculous things, if there's conception, and then probably the final one is, don't take the life of this child. You can carry the child, and there's many young people that are unable to conceive that will pay for all your medical care. that will allow you have to maintain objectivity. You can't go down the road of emotion. Right now, that individual that's been raped is in a state of shock. Physical shock, emotional shock, psychological shock. To try to talk with them at that moment that they want that shot, it's like talking to a brick wall. I mean, when I looked at this 19-year-old girl, there was no ability to communicate rationally with her, nor with her parents. Because immediately they said, rape, baby, no. And somehow you need to intervene. It's situational. So I hope that helps. Do you want me to say it all again, the ways that I would approach it, or you got it, Jessica? Yes, ma'am. Can you tell us who you are and where you're from? From where? Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say Manhattan, New York, but yeah. No, that's all right. I Manhattan, Kansas is just fine by me. So it's a couple. Have they already discussed that they don't want children? Okay. So go ahead. Okay. So they need counseling without a doubt before they get married, and you need to ask the hard questions. Why don't you want children? And then you share. You become so. Remember, and I'm going to talk about it. I think in illness, you can be a prophet, priest, and king at that moment. To that, we'll just say the woman doesn't want children. So the way you're a prophet is you give truth winsomely in a kind manner. You go to Psalm 139. You go to the passages that children are a gift of the Lord. You go to the concept of you marry to the confession in all those verses. So that's kind of one, dealing with the woman as a prophet. As a priest, you mediate on behalf of the couple somehow, if you can bring them together and discuss differences biblically, leaving your heart, in a sense, outside the room. And as a king, you're a protectorate. So you want to protect that union, that bond, if they were to get married, so there is not a clashing at the beginning. I can invariably tell you, if that's at the beginning of their marriage, it won't last. Because the urge of a woman to either have or not have is something that you can't measure. It's not quantifiable. Yes, sir. Name and phone number and all that. Goldmeyer. Sorry, I don't have my glasses on.
What?
I don't have my glasses on. Because I want you to think that I have good vision. It is, man? Oh, okay. I got you, Myra. Sorry. Sure. So if you're good friends with the woman, I wouldn't have you counsel the dude. But if you're good friends with the woman, I think you can... that's why we're here. I'm trying to give you tools in your armamentarium. So I think you can do some counseling. You can till the soil, so to speak. But yes, without a doubt, they need to go to their elder, their parents, a counselor, a biblical counselor of some kind, a nuthetic counselor, someone that deals with it. But you, as a sister in Christ, can and should engage if they're wrestling with it. Oh, I really love this guy, but he wants to have 10 kids because he came from a family of 10, and I don't want any. The bottom line is she's going to need to submit eventually, right? Was there someone over here before I go back to Christy? If not, I've got like a bunch of questions here. Go ahead. It's biblically okay to not have children, but the motive of a couple that doesn't want them needs to be explored on why they don't. I gave you just a couple of real good reasons maybe why they shouldn't. If it's going to harm the mother because she has an inverted uterus that's small, then the counsel is, well, you can try to have a child, but you will die giving birth. Or, I told you about the austere environment. You know, I mean, you gotta consider where you're at. To be here in this first world order problem and not want to have children needs to be explored. But your role is just to be a friend and point them in the right direction. What are you most scared about right now in your life? What am I most scared about? It's a great question. I'm not scared of much. I'm not scared to die. I don't fear man very much. Perfect love does cast out fear. But what I'm most scared about right now is not providing for my family. I'm looking for short ones as opposed to biographies. Oh, this is such a wonderful one. I can't believe you exposed yourself. Thank you for not writing your name. So I, like you, have a chronic illness that I will probably have my whole life. Do you have any words of encouragement? Paul had a thorn in his side that he prayed, and God left him with his thorn in his side, that I would couch under the concept of a chronic illness. And plus everything else, he was left for dead and beaten, and then upon all that, he had the weighty matters of the churches that constantly weighed heavy upon him, and he just praised God. So I think, although you may have this thing called illness, and we'll talk about it on Sunday if you're there, it's okay. It more than likely is a sanctification tool that God requires of you. I will share with you another 25A type of event is, do not wait to have a diagnosis of cancer to understand your relationship with your spouse and how good it is to have a wife or a husband that loves you so unconditionally. Do not wait to say you've only got a couple of years to live to appreciate your loved ones. And it could be mom and dad. It doesn't have to be a husband or wife, because as I look around, there's not a lot of young husbands and wives in here. I am, Lord willing. Any other questions? If not, I'm just going to keep going through. I am, Lord willing, good perspective, going to pursue a nursing degree when I graduate high school. Good for you. And have often thought about being a nurse in the military. What is it like being in the nursing department of the military, or whatever it's called? I like your honesty. So I'm pretty vehement. If this is, and I can't tell really by the writing, which is great, it's kind of generic. If you're a woman and you want to enter the military, I have a great difficulty with that. In general, it isn't that there weren't Florence Nightingales. It's not that I'm a misogynist or a sexist. I just think the military environment, and there's some biblical passages, typically only deal with men going to war, not women. It's kind of thin ice. I have no difficulty if you entered the military, but if you're going to enter the military as a woman, do not enter the army. It's a little gruff the way they treat nurses. I would, believe it or not, this is coming from a retired army guy, I would rather you went into the Air Force or the Navy. And the reason for that is they tend to indoctrinate their females much better than the army does. The army is a very big organization of over 500,000 individuals, where the Air Force and the Navy are smaller entities within the Department of Defense, and thus they can tailor to a diverse group. Would you agree, brother or Matt? So we got a couple of Air Force guys in here. How do you think the tenor with women within the Air Force versus the guys that beat you in football?
The Air Force is just renowned for having a
hospital. Yep. So I was in the Air Force, and I was an E-5, I was a sergeant, and I lived in a domicile that they provided for me. And when I entered the Army, it took my rank to become a major to have the same kind of housing as I had when I was an enlisted guy in the Air Force. It is a better, and culture is a good word. I mean, you guys like wear backpacks at your campus where it's the academy at West Point, and you guys get to go to McDonald's. Well, in any case, in what ways? So I hope that answers it. I have no difficulty if you're a woman and you want to be a nurse and you want to enter the military. And if you even want to be in the Army, great. But know that it's gruff. And I don't have a lot of good biblical backing to tell you that you should enter the military as a woman in any capacity. In what ways has experience in military, in contrast to the medical field of the sixth commandment, has my opinion changed? It doesn't matter if my opinion changed. The sixth commandment still reigns supreme. So that's just at the outset. I can tell you that I've operated on Taliban in Afghanistan. How did I know that? We were trained on the types of tattoos that and it's not top secret anymore, the types of tattoos that they had versus regular tattoos and ink. And plus Special Forces was trying to kill them, but they didn't, so they injured them, so they brought them to us. And then after we rescued them, then Special Forces took them to this Connex in the back 40. And I don't know what they did. The military says you maintain your lane, and that's what I did. My role, taking the Hippocratic Oath, which only about 30% of medical schools do now, is to first do no harm. Primum non nocere. And I'm going to take care of whoever is on the operating room table. I don't ask them their religion. I don't ask them anything. Well, they've got a tube down their throat, but I just take care of them because they're created. So what's my biblical deontological view? Is they're created in God's image. Would you say that all Christians... Oh, wait, I better read some of these before I say them out loud. Ooh, I don't want to answer that one. I think I could address this one. Would you say that all Christians have a responsibility to make up in their own mind their convictions on each of the popular hot topics within medical ethics? Yes. You should never violate your conscience. And how to balance, I think this is directed at me, how to balance not enough time. I think you ought to consider extending your conferences from just 4 lectures, from coming in late on a Friday night and then having to possibly travel on the Lord's Day and just maybe start on a Thursday and go to a Monday and find speakers that can do 4 or 5. I mean, just so you know, this that I showed you that I had done at office something is 100 pages, and as Elder Milroy told me, the last time I taught it, it took 12 weeks at an adult Sunday school class. And here I am struggling to try to impart truth to you. Dr. J, I like that. Haven't been called that in a while. I have a friend that needed a heart transplant. When you speak against the donation of these vital organs, are you saying that even if everyone knows this girl will die if she doesn't get the transplant, to not do it? No. I told you my opinion, my medical opinion on different organs, but I didn't remember what I said. I said, this is not a salvific decision. You're not going to go to hell if you donate your organs. It's just something to consider. But wouldn't that be potentially letting 2 lives slip away when you could save one? Why not try to save one at least? Number one, heart transplant is not 100%. so you may not be saving. And the concept of matching a heart from a non-family member is really, it's still fraught with multiple complications, not just medically, but financially to the family. Oh, by the way, thank you. How will you save my friend? Well, number one, you should all be in prayer. I told you about my three-legged stool. I stand here before you today feeling great because of the prayers of the saints. I really believe that. Before our heavenly, he's been merciful. And I'll tell you why I know that. Because when I go to see my oncologist, he just sits there giddy. And if you've ever been to a medical oncologist, they would make great poker players. You don't know if they're happy, sad, or what. And this guy is in the corner like, you look so good. And I tell him why I look good, and he's like, oh, okay. I just tell him why. I keep taking my chemo. That doesn't mean I throw away my chemo. This is a tough one. That's why I just have difficulty with heart transplant because the death of that individual. And really, if you want to use that logic, they can both die. The individual that's giving the heart is definitely dying and dies. And the individual that gets the heart transplant may also die. I don't know the exact statistic, but it's pretty high on rejection rates of heart transplants. I am not an organ donor because of a personal conviction to respect my body. Good. Could guilt from others be God's way of convicting me? Guilt from others be God's way of convicting me. So I'd probably change some of the words in here. I think God can use others to help bring conviction into your life, right? We're to sharpen one another, right? As iron sharpens iron. We're to be in each other's face in a loving fashion. And if God can use a donkey, he can probably use me to speak some level of truth into your lives. So I wouldn't, if you're feeling it, I mean, if I were to decipher this and it were just you and me, I would tell you that maintain your conviction, and we need to explore this concept of guilt. Because you don't want that to be your motivator. Should I have more respect for others than myself? I think if you went to Philippians 2, you are to consider others more highly than yourself. You'd have to help me understand what respect means. I think you ought to, I don't think you ought to have so much respect for others that you violate your own conscience. Does that help you, whoever you may be? But you should respect others as, right, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So there is that level of give and take respect. But if people don't respect themselves, and you should discern that, then you just need to love them. Other questions? You've got about no minutes. Maybe we'll sing another psalm if not. Okay, all right. Are you going to be, is he the last question giver? Okay. Make it a good one.
Right. You mentioned your sources in the first. Is there a particular source that you would recommend as kind of a beginning point? There were some names you mentioned of Christian people.
Yeah. First and foremost is maturity of the individual that you're going to give the resource to. I've just read, so not that this matters a hoot to you, but I probably read over 1,000 pages in preparation for your lectures today. I just like to read. So I don't want to recommend that one. Okay, if you're going to read this with an elder nearby or a parent, this is one of the newest books that have come out. It's called Christian Bioethics. and it's a guide for pastors, healthcare professionals, and families. And it's by Ben Mitchell and Joy Riley. Ben Mitchell is a PhD. He's a philosopher and ethicist. And then Joy Riley is a physician, a family practice doc. And what's great about this book is that there are scenarios in the front, like an organ transplant scenario. And then there's a give and take between the theologian and the doctor, the doc. And then there are questions at the end, such as, well, and then there are questions to consider. A doctor was, like this one, a doctor's called to see a patient in the middle of the night. She's dying of cervical cancer, and she's in excruciating pain, and all she wants is help. He gives her 10 milligrams of morphine, and within 30 minutes, she's dead. The phrase that she uses is, let's get this over with. And then there's questions, why was the doctor called to see the patient? What did the patient mean when they said, let's get this over with? What was the physician's attitude at 2 o'clock in the morning when they're disrupted from their sleep? Describe the communication or the lack of it between a doctor and a patient. So this is one. And for tomorrow, for the last lecture, I'll bring a couple of resource names. I think that's a great... I think Principles of Conduct by John Murray, if you can get it, it's out of print. It's been out of print for about 40, 50 years. Principles of Conduct by John Murray is an excellent read. It probably takes a collegiate level to really wrap your head around it. And then there's a book called Medical Ethics by Ed Payne, by Franklin Payne, that you could probably get. You just call him up. He's a ruling elder in Augusta at First Pres. He's a PCA ruling elder. And you could call him and say, hey, you know, how can I get your book, Medical Ethics? Franklin E. Payne. But he goes by Ed Payne. P-A-Y-N-E. Medical Ethics.